today on Against the Grain. Where did they get this idea that political intervention to address poverty and inequality is wrong-headed because society and markets are self-regulating and so should be left to themselves? I'm CS. Fred Block discusses the impact of Malthusian and other ideas on welfare policy in late 20th century US and early 19th century England, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Ideas can be powerful. They can wield enormous power when taken up by elites and governments and makers of policy, policy that affects people, including marginalized and poor people. That's one of the fundamental lessons of a book called The Power of Market Fundamentalism, written by Fred Block and Margaret Summers. One set of ideas the authors focus on belong to Thomas Malthus, whose ideas about food scarcity and population growth spurred England to move from a system of poor relief to a much harsher, much more stingy regime. According to Block and Summers, those Malthusian ideas played a prominent and insidious role in another nation a century and a half later, namely the U.S., in 1996, when Bill Clinton signed into law a bill that dismantled the safety net that was the federal welfare system for six decades. Fred Block is a sociology professor at the University of California, Davis, and his and Margaret Summers' book is just out in paperback. Its full title is The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Carl Polanyi's Critique. When Fred Block joined me in studio, I asked him how he defined the term market fundamentalism.
It's a term used to describe the same thing that other people refer to as neoliberalism or the Washington Consensus or free market rhetoric. We use the term precisely because of the fundamentalism part, because it evokes the similarities to Christian fundamentalism and Islamic fundamentalism and Jewish fundamentalism, to all the forms of religious fundamentalism where people know what they know with enormous certainty. And so we're arguing that the kind of free market ideas that have dominated represent a kind of intellectual fundamentalism where the people who say the market will solve our problems, that if we can only restrain the growth of the state and allow markets to self-regulate and lower government regulation and lower government taxes and lower government provision of services to people, that the market, this magnificent instrument for processing information and fitting supply with demand and so forth, that will solve all of our problems. We consider that to be a fundamentalist doctrine because, as with religious fundamentalisms, it's not based upon an empirical analysis on science or any of the kind of normal ways in which we think people come to understand the world. It's based, as with the religious fundamentalisms, on belief that people are convinced that the stories in the Bible are literally true, and they choose to believe that and use that as a template for seeing everything else. So our argument is that the Milton Friedmans and their followers who've advanced this ideology so insistently are really immune to countervailing facts, countervailing theories, and so forth. They believe what they believe, and there's kind of no way to get them off that.
Market fundamentalism, you write, has become the dominant policy perspective across the global economy. How quickly did it become so? How many years or decades did this revival of market fundamentalism take?
Well, the process really took off in the 1970s. So as a number of people have pointed out, the kind of core intellectual group that advanced these ideas had begun meeting right after World War II. There was something called the Mont Pelerin Society that Friedrich Hayek, the Austrian economist who was one of the major figures in this movement, pulled together people from the U.S. and Europe, and they started meeting. But through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and even halfway into the 70s, they were pretty marginal. They had supporters among the very rich. They ran some think tanks, but their ideas weren't in the center of political or economic debate. So the turning point was in the 1970s when we had stagflation, and it was at that point that this kind of theoretical intellectual revolution took place, and the previous Keynesian understandings of how an economy worked were effectively overthrown. That within the economics profession in the United States, for example, the followers of Milton Friedman were considered to have successfully routed their Keynesian opponents. And so over the next few decades, the 80s and 90s, this set of doctrines intensified its effect. I mean, became introduced into more and more realms of policy, into welfare policy, as we'll talk about, into financial policy, into antitrust policy, and essentially became the basis for the tax cutting, the austerity policies, the opening up of markets, the trade agreement, the notorious trade agreements, and so on.
So the section of the book, The Power of Market Fundamentalism, that we've agreed to discuss in detail this hour, involves a comparison of two episodes in history, two welfare revolutions, or maybe we could call them anti-welfare revolutions. One culminated in the 1996 U.S. federal law signed by Bill Clinton that's been called welfare reform or welfare deform by its opponents. The object was to end welfare as we know it, and Bill Clinton had made that part of his campaign promise. And the other episode culminated in a law enacted in England long before, in 1834, and this law overturned or replaced certain laws that provided relief to the poor, to poor people, to needy people in England. What motivated you to compare these two historical episodes?
Well, the thing is that one's doing this kind of historical comparative work, one really confronts the reality that, I think it was Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. I mean, that at best you get parallels. But when we started thinking about it and digging into it, this was a case where these two turning points separated by 162 years were remarkably similar in terms of the way in which the change happened, extremely similar in the ideological preparation. So I guess that the key turning point for us was that we started reading very carefully the essay on population that T.R. Malthus, the famous English scholar, had published in 1798. And it struck us that its whole argument was so remarkably similar to the extremely influential book that Charles Murray published in the U.S. called Losing Ground, that was extremely influential in shaping the debate leading up to the 1996 legislation, that parallel just hit us over the head, and then we were kind of saw the necessity of kind of fleshing out how this strange historical similarity came about. And I stress strange because even though legislatively and as policies, the similarities are enormously great, the context is just extremely different. I mean, that in England in the first part of the 19th century, the welfare recipients were white people. They were rural farm laborers and their families. In the U.S., the debate was about the population mostly of women who were served by the program, aid to families with dependent children, where that group included many women of color, African-Americans, Latinos, and so forth. So there was a huge change in the recipients of welfare, the type of aid that they were getting, but the larger political context of the debate was so remarkably similar.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Fred Block joins me. He's research professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis, and he's co-author with Margaret Summers of The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Carl Polanyi's Critique. It's now out in paperback from Harvard University Press. So I want to talk in some detail about the essay by Malthus that you just referred to and by Charles Murray in the U.S., more than, I think, 150 years later. But let's talk about England before the drive to get rid of the what are called the old poor laws began. So let's say pre-1800, what was the nature of the welfare system in England, and to what degree were the poor given relief, given assistance by the government?
Well, we generally think of welfare and welfare provision as distinctly modern, as something that began in the 20th century. But England's history was quite different from the rest of Europe, and it has to do with the Protestant Reformation and Henry VIII, the one with all of those wives, some of whom died under mysterious circumstances. Mm. And so what happened was that Henry essentially expropriated the lands of the Catholic Church. They were huge landowners. And what the Protestant Reformation in England meant, one of the main things it meant, was that the lands were taken away from the Catholic Church. Now, this was a problem because in England, as across much of Europe, charity was organized by the Catholic Church. And so the people who fell through the cracks would essentially be taken care of by the church, and their accumulation of property was useful because they had economic resources and they could provide a certain amount of charity. So when Henry did this, he realized he had to take some compensating action. And so there were a series of poor laws that were passed from the late 16th century onward, and what they did was said at the most local level of government, which was called the parish, and sometimes parishes are as small as 300, 400 people, that at the parish level, there would be imposed a local tax on those people with property, and the revenues collected through that tax would be used to support the poor. And this meant the elderly, the disabled, orphans, and people who couldn't find any work, the indigent. And the idea was that at the local parish level, if you were a citizen of that parish, the parish was obligated to provide some care, essentially enough food to keep you alive. Now, because this was a local arrangement, the generosity or stinginess varied enormously from parish to parish. Some were more generous, some were less generous. But the idea was that this was a thoroughly institutionalized system that existed for something like 200 years. And people really knew they could depend upon it. So it was a genuine safety net. And there are, in fact, historians who've made the argument that England's earlier leap into industrialization than anywhere else in the world was a consequence of having this safety net arrangement, because people were willing to take risks because their knowledge that the parish would take care of them protected them. I mean, that if their entrepreneurial activity didn't succeed, they knew they wouldn't starve. They could come back to the parish and they would be taken care of.
So that was the welfare regime, the safety net regime in England, pretty much prior to 1800. And then there are a number of things that happen that you lay out in this book. 1795, there were problems with food imports, a disastrous harvest, there were riots, and then there was an effort to reform things via what's called the Speenumland Act. And this is also discussed in your book. But I want to focus on this essay on the principle of population, which you referred to earlier, written by Thomas Robert Malthus, came out in 1798. So this is it's almost 40 years before the law that really changed things in England, that took away poor relief from so many people who were needy in that society. That was the 1834 Poor Law Act. So in 1798, you have this essay by Malthus. And what did he argue the poor laws, as they existed, did in relation to poverty? Did he think that the laws alleviated poverty?
No, quite the contrary. So, I mean, Malthus is to this day remembered as the founder of the study of population. And many people will remember learning about what Malthus argued about the fundamental law of population, that human population will grow geometrically, but the food supply grows just arithmetically, meaning that human population is always at danger of outrunning the food supply. That's the part of Malthus which most people remember. But when you sit down and you read through the whole essay, it becomes clear that the essay is a polemic against the way the old poor law worked. And that essentially what Malthus says is that the conventional view, the standard view on which the poor law policy is based, is that there's this poverty and that everybody agrees had been growing in the last decades of the 18th century. I mean, we know that at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there's a lot of economic displacement, that there are crafts that are employ a lot of people that are rising and falling. And so the number of people who are dependent upon this safety net system has been rising. I mean, that's the context in which Malthus is writing. And so he says that the conventional view is that there's poverty and then we have the poor law to alleviate poverty. And he says this is precisely wrong. The reason that England has so much more poverty than the countries in continental Europe is precisely because the poor law is itself the problem. The poor law is encouraging people who shouldn't be having families and having children to reproduce. And so it's contributing very directly to population growth that is in excess of what the English economy can support at that point in time.
He was influenced by a guy named Joseph Townsend, who was a critic of the poor law. What story about goats and dogs did Townsend tell that had a big impact on Malthus?
Right. So Townsend had written in 1786 a pamphlet called The Dissertation on the Poor Law. And he told in the pamphlet a story about an island in the Pacific, the island of San Juan, that was about 200 miles off the coast of Chile. And according to Townsend, the Spanish had landed some goats on this island with the idea that the goats would reproduce and that Spanish ships that were at sea for a long time could stop there, kill some of the goats, and use it to feed the crew on the ship who were not, getting very much fresh meat after they had been away from Spain for months and months and months. But this actually worked, and so the population of goats on the island grew. But what the Spanish authorities soon realized is that the people who were benefiting from this were pirates who were essentially attacking Spanish ships and stealing their treasure and so forth. So the Spanish authorities decided to land a bunch of dogs on the island on the theory that the dogs would eat the goats and eliminate the pirates' food supply. And I guess the Spanish authorities figured they would just find another way to keep their own sailors from starvation. So the story that Joseph Townsend told was that later travelers to these islands reported that both the goats and the dogs essentially had flourished on the island, but that there was a kind of natural process that only the slower goats were captured by the dogs, and only the more able dogs were able to get their dinner. So this is the earliest form of the survival of the fittest, of the Darwinian theory of evolution that wasn't articulated by Darwin until almost a century later. I have a footnote here, which is that I actually went to Chile. I didn't go all the way to the islands, but I read up on the most recent historical account. And what most observers found is that the dogs, in fact, didn't survive. There wasn't a kind of natural equilibrium of goats and dogs. The goats survived because they could move very quickly in the hills. The dogs couldn't catch the goats.
Fred Block is his name. He's research professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. He's author of The Vampire State and Other Myths and Fallacies About the U.S. Economy. He's co-editor with Matthew Keller of the book State of Innovation, the U.S. Government's Role in Technology Development. And he teamed up with Margaret Summers, who is a professor of sociology and history at the University of Michigan, on a book that is now out in paperback. It's called The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Carl Polanyi's Critique. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you were talking, Fred, about kind of the biological considerations, the biological emphasis that Malthus picked up from Townsend and was part of his thinking even maybe before he read Joseph Townsend. And a key theme that keeps coming up in this chapter is the preference for natural law, the laws of nature, understanding, Malthus understanding that the laws of nature governed human society as opposed to the laws of people, the laws made by humans. For example, the poor law, legislation that would be imposed, maybe in his phraseology, on people and maybe upset that natural balance. Can you talk about how important it was to Malthus that things be understood in naturalistic terms in a way that would view social laws, political laws, as a kind of interference?
Right. So this was the point that Townsend was making with the goats and the dogs, that the poor law for Townsend and for Malthus represented this artificial insertion by government, by politics, into the sphere of nature. And what Townsend and Malthus said is that if we eliminate that artificial interference, by which he meant giving poor people assistance so that they could buy food and maintain a shelter, that if we eliminated that assistance and returned to the previous, more natural state, which they claimed existed at a moment, earlier moment in history, then the same natural process that had created the balance between goats and dogs on the island in the South Pacific, that same natural law would essentially eliminate the problem of excessive amounts of poverty. And it would do that because the poor would essentially be able to see without any confusion the laws of the market. They would be able to see that the only way in which you could get food is if you worked for it. And so they would learn to have the self-discipline and drive to get a job, keep a job, and earn the money to escape poverty. The other side of it, on which Malthus was extremely explicit, was that Malthus believed that there was no inherent right to reproduce, that the only people who should have children are the people who had accumulated enough wealth and enough income that they could support those children themselves. And the complexity is that Malthus also was totally opposed to birth control and abortion. So essentially he was saying he believed that poor people had no right to sexuality, that they had to restrain their sexual urges until they had achieved enough economic independence that they could then afford to enter into sexual relations and be at risk for having children. So the idea that was kind of central to his argument is that if you suddenly took away the whole system of poor relief, not immediately, but pretty quickly, the poor would understand the new realities of the labor market, of the necessity of controlling their sexual impulses, and they would start working hard and stop having children that they couldn't afford to support, and the problem of poverty would magically disappear.
And so we have Malthus saw nature as a self-regulating system, saw society as also self-regulating. So when untouched or not interfered with by political intervention, society constrained by things like scarcity will tend toward a kind of equilibrium and order. And so his ideas are extremely influential, and they lead to this 1834 Poor Law Act amendment, which makes poor relief conditional on being incarcerated in a workhouse, in a poorhouse. And so many people are thrown off poor relief and poverty gets much worse. And you can read all about it in Fred Block and Margaret Summer's book, The Power of Market Fundamentalism. Such an influential essay. So I'm assuming, Fred, that this was based on, Malthus's argument was based on empirical evidence, that he had data and facts to back him up.
No, that's the whole point, is that he essentially constructed his argument based on thought experiments. And so the thought experiment had been pioneered by physicists, and they used it to think about the relations among the planets and so forth. But Malthus essentially said, let's engage in the thought experiment of taking away the system of poor relief that we have. And essentially, from the first principles that he had laid out, the thought experiment led him to the conclusion that if you eliminated the system of poor relief, that England would return to this idyllic earlier situation in which there was no longer a problem of poverty because the poor would get the signals of the market, work hard for a living, and restrain their sexual impulses. So the relevant story about empirical data is that after Malthus, there was a stalemate. There were supporters of Malthus who wanted to eliminate the poor law, and then there were many people who supported the poor law, and there was a kind of extended period of stalemate. And the stalemate was broken in 1832, the Whig Party took over Parliament, and they set up a royal commission to study the issue of the poor law. And that royal commission carried out a survey, which is seen as kind of one of the first sociological surveys. They sent out questionnaires to the parish officials. But what actually had happened was that in the aftermath of Malthus, there was essentially 30 years of Malthusian propaganda, essentially people reading Malthus and other people elaborating his arguments and so forth. And all of those arguments were that the existing poor law made the poor lazy and led them to reproduce like bunnies. So the empirical basis for the poor law report was that they would send this questionnaire to parish officials, and they would say, what has been the effect of the poor law on the work ethic of the poor? And the people would write back, oh, it's disastrous. These people, you can't get them to work for anything. They're so happy just receiving their relief. And then they would say, and what's been the effect of the poor law on population, on bastardy, of children being born out of wedlock? And the people would write back and say, ugh, it's just horrible, that they're having children right and left, and they deliberately, I mean, Ronald Reagan's famous story about the welfare Cadillacs, about the people who were collecting multiple incomes from AFDC and living high off the hog, are repeated endlessly in the actual data that the poor, or the alleged data that the poor law report propagated. So essentially a kind of what Malthus consolidated is this highly prejudicial account of the English poor that then various elite groups, political leaders, religious leaders, took on as an accurate description. I mean, it's as though after Donald Trump, speeches about what black communities are like, people sent out surveys to white suburbanites saying, what's life like in the ghetto? And they would just reproduce what Trump had said.
Fred Block, research professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis, and co-author of the book, The Power of Market Fundamentalism, published by Harvard University Press. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Fred. We'll bring the discussion to the U.S. and talk about welfare reform and Charles Murray, and try, if we have time, to bring matters up to the present. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Fred Block is research professor of sociology at UC Davis. He's president of the Center for Engaged Scholarship, and we have a link to that center on our website, againstthegrain.org, where you'll also find a link to the book we are discussing today. It's called The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Carl Polanyi's Critique. He co-authored it with Margaret Summers, who teaches sociology and history at the University of Michigan. So let's turn now to the U.S., because as we said earlier this hour, your and Margaret's project, part of it was to compare what happened to welfare, to poor relief in England in the 1700s and into the 1800s with what happened to the welfare system in the U.S. leading up to and including the welfare, quote, reform law signed by Bill Clinton in 1996. And you have in this book a nice kind of summary of the history of federal welfare assistance in the U.S. You write that it begins with the New Deal, with a program later renamed Aid to Families with Dependent Children, AFDC, and there were attacks on it in the 1960s. Welfare becomes racialized, but that a lot of the efforts to replace AFDC lost steam, and even during the Reagan years, the program was not overhauled. But then in the 1990s, we get Clinton, we get his campaign promise to end welfare as we know it. We get conservatives and their think tanks revving up their attacks on welfare as we knew it. And then Charles Murray, who you've mentioned, a well-known conservative intellectual. He co-authored The Bell Curve. He produced a book, and this actually was before the 1990s. In 1984, his book Losing Ground comes out, and you write that it was the turning point that shifted the welfare debate and hastened the elimination of welfare as we knew it. What did Charles Murray argue in his book Losing Ground?
Well, essentially, Murray started with talking about the war on poverty as something that actually didn't stop in the early 1970s, but had continued up till 1984. And he describes all of the federal spending against poverty. And he says, but look, the problem has just grown worse and worse. So essentially, he starts out by replicating Malthus's logic. And then Malthus had started by saying that it is the programs designed to fight poverty that are really the cause of poverty. And Murray essentially replicated, said we've spent billions and billions, but we've only made the problem worse. So what's remarkable is that Murray actually doesn't mention Malthus in the book, but that basically what he did was rewrite Malthus's argument completely for the late 20th century. And the giveaway is that after essentially making the argument that is now familiar, that giving people AFDC made them lazy and dependent, they stopped looking for jobs, they just assumed that they would get money from the government and sat on their behinds, and the argument that it suddenly became attractive for women to give birth out of wedlock, and so and the more children they had, the more assistance they got, so that there was an epidemic of illegitimate births. After making all those arguments, Murray then says, well, let's do a thought experiment. I mean, and he essentially replicates Malthus's thought experiment. We take away all of this assistance from one day to the next. We announce that, you know, 1 year hence, there'll be no more aid to families with dependent children. What will happen? And his logic is exactly the same as Malthus, that the poor will see that they have to obey the signals of the market, and they will essentially clean themselves up, get off the couch, and go look for work and accept the self-discipline that's required to succeed in the marketplace. And lo and behold, they will also stop having these children out of wedlock, recognize that they should only have children when they've acquired sufficient amount of economic security to provide for those. He then argues that the problem of poverty will go away. And part of the point that we're making is that this invocation of this kind of natural process, that if we get away from the artificial state interference and just get back to the old-fashioned values and the natural way of doing things, the problem will take care of itself. And so a part of what we're trying to get at here is that this libertarian rhetoric, of which, you know, this is one part that we see from Rand Paul and from much of the Republican apparatus, from the Koch brothers and so forth, all has this same internal structure, that there's this natural logic to the market, that politics, which is ugly and biased and coercive, can be kept to an absolute minimum if we shift away from government to allowing these natural market processes to make these decisions. And it is seductive because politics is always problematic. And so the fantasy that the natural logic of a market economy will make everything right has become very attractive. I mean, is kind of now deeply built into the worldview of a lot of these Tea Party people and a good chunk of the Republican political base.
You've told me that Malthus's arguments were not backed up by hard data. Were Murray's?
No, it was the same idea, that there's data is presented in an ornamental way, but that the kind of core arguments about causality are made based upon thought experiment in deduction from his basic premises. There is no evidence presented that public assistance makes people dependent and lazy or encourages excessive childbearing and so forth. I mean, he doesn't do any of that. He simply assumes that everything that's bad is a result of these interferences into the natural market processes.
I'm C.S. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Fred Block is research professor of sociology at UC Davis, and we are talking about his and Margaret Summers' book. It's called The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Karl Polanyi's Critique. So, riding kind of the wave of Murrayan logic and therefore Malthusian logic, there is an effort to hold Bill Clinton to his campaign promise to end welfare as we know it. There is then the welfare reform law of 1996 that Clinton signs and that he and Hillary Clinton still stand behind. It's called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunities Reconciliation Act. What did it mandate and what were its consequences, and do those consequences fit with what Murray might have predicted and what Malthus might have predicted?
Well, this is one of the differences between the English and the U.S. case. In the English case, what they did in the 1834 law was move poor relief from the local parish to a centralized national agency. And in the U.S. case, where assistance through AFDC was basically a federal program administered at the state level, what they did was they dismantled the federal piece and turned it back to the states. This is important because the federal courts had essentially established assistance through AFDC as a right, and potential recipients who were denied for arbitrary reason or who weren't getting enough to survive on had been able to go into the federal courts, and particularly in the late 60s and 70s, there had been a number of very progressive federal court rulings that had supported the rights of AFDC recipients. So what the 1996 legislation did was, by abolishing the program called AFDC, they also abolished the entitlement. And what happened as the program was sent to the states to administer was that the states were required to set a 5-year lifetime time limit, and they had the option of setting shorter time limits, and they also had the right to sanction people by essentially cutting them off the rolls for failing to jump through bureaucratic hoops and so forth. So the basic story is that the logic of the legislation was work first, that we want to get people off the welfare rolls, we want to get them into jobs. And so what almost all of the states did was they set up barriers for anybody new getting on to the new system, which is called temporary aid for needy families. So when you come into a welfare office now, they essentially push you into looking for work, whatever low-wage work happens to be available. And you basically have to look for work for a period of time before they'll even provide you with any assistance, no matter how desperate your circumstances might be. Now, there's a lot of variation across states, and what's happened is that in the more conservative states, the program has become extremely restrictive, and governors and state legislators have been empowered to take the money that's supposed to go to poor families through TANF. They're essentially allowed to use it for other purposes. So it's diverted to child care programs and abstinence training and all kinds of other programs. So when you look at the data, I didn't bring the actual numbers with me, but back in the days before 1996, when the AFDC program existed, the vast majority of poor families with children were receiving some kind of government assistance. And that as a consequence of the shift to TANF, the percentage of poor families with children who receive government assistance has dropped precipitously. I think it might now be only a quarter of such families receive assistance beyond the food stamp program. And the most dramatic consequence we saw in the 2009-2010 recession period. You know, we know that there was a global economic crisis. Unemployment in the U.S. went up to about 10%. In every previous recession since World War II, the AFDC program had served as a kind of counter-cyclical mechanism that people who were thrown out of work, who couldn't take care of their families, who weren't eligible for unemployment insurance, could sign up for AFDC as a safety net program. And so one always saw that as the unemployment level rose, the AFDC rolls also rose very significantly. But the amazing thing is that even though the 2009-2010 recession was much worse than previous recessions, the increase in the TANF load was very small. And in some states, they continued to cut the TANF load even as the state was suffering from 10% unemployment. So basically, the U.S. was saying, I mean, the cruelest social policy possible, I mean, that to people who had lost their jobs through no fault of their own because there was a global economic crisis, I'm sorry, we can't give you unemployment insurance. We can't give you welfare. You know, maybe private charity will be able to help you. That strikes me as just extraordinarily inhumane. The other point that I would make here is that one of the ways that we describe the argument, the anti-welfare argument that I've been describing, is the perversity thesis, which is the idea that Malthus and Murray, the argument they're making is that liberals, do-gooders, they think that they're helping the poor by giving them this free assistance. But in fact, what we know is that they're making things worse because they're making people dependent. They're sending them the wrong messages. And so they're intensifying the poverty that they wanted. So a well-meaning policy has the perverse consequence of making poverty even worse. So the right has used this perversity thesis to argue that almost any form of government assistance, I mean, some people, well, we saw that in the Romney campaign when he talked about the 47% of people who are takers, that the idea is that they're all welfare chiselers, whether they earned their Social Security or whatever government pension they might have gotten. And what this has led to is kind of this trope that giving poor people money will hurt them. And what's important to emphasize here is that particularly over the last 10 years, there's been around the world a very large-scale experiment with programs which are called cash transfers. Some of them are called conditional cash transfers, and programs were developed in Brazil and Mexico. Some of them started as paying poor families to keep their children in school, paying poor families something more to take their children in for pediatric checkups. But these programs have expanded, and some social scientists have estimated that there's something like 1 billion people, because the programs exist in India and China as well, there are something like 1 billion people who are receiving these kinds of cash transfers. And so we now have a growing body of empirical research. And lo and behold, when you give poor people in Mexico or Brazil or India or China some supplemental cash, it turns out that it makes their lives better. They're able to feed their families. They're able to make plans. They're able to invest in things, to make entrepreneurial choices. It doesn't, in fact, make them dependent and passive or encourage them to have more children or whatever. So we've been in the U.S. essentially making social policy kind of within this mythical view that giving people assistance is in fact something that hurts them.
Fred Block, sociology professor at UC Davis. He is co-editor with Matthew Keller of the book State of Innovation. He is author of The Vampire State and Other Myths and Fallacies About the U.S. Economy. And we've been talking about his book that he co-authored with Margaret Summers. It's The Power of Market Fundamentalism, Karl Polanyi's Critique. We have a link to that book now out in paperback on our website, againstthegrain.org. Fred, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.